I sat down, and now a new vision, Bethany, in her room, sitting up straight, knees together in a light cotton dress, violin at her chin, looking at him, those green cat-like eyes. When the bell rang for recess, he acted like there was something important in his desk that he couldn't find. After everyone left the classroom, he stood up and maneuvered himself in such a way that, for anyone watching, would have looked like someone slowly hula-hooping without a hula hoop. The kids marched to the playground, marched with purpose and slow resolve, even though they were by now surging with the energy that accumulates in an 11-year-old body sitting rigidly still for hours under Miss Bowles's imperious gaze. They marched in total silence, single file on the far right side of the corridor past all the signs the faculty had helpfully taped to the white concrete walls, one or two of which promoted some kind of learning is fun message, while the rest attempted strict behavior management. Keep hands and feet to yourself. Quiet voices only. Walk, don't run. Wait your turn. Use polite language. Don't use more toilet paper than you need. Eat before talking. Use table manners. Respect personal space. Raise your hand. Do not speak unless called on. Stay in line. Apologize when needed. Follow directions. Use soap appropriately. To most of the students, the education they received at school was only an incidental thing. To them, the overwhelming point of school was to learn how to behave in school, how to contort themselves to the school's rigid rules. Take, for example, bathroom breaks. No subject was more highly managed than the students' various excreta. Getting a bathroom pass was an elaborate ritual whereby Miss Bowles would, if you asked really nicely and convinced her that it was indeed an emergency and not some ploy to get out of class to smoke cigarettes or drink alcohol or do drugs, fill out this bathroom pass about the length of the Constitution. She'd write down your name and the time of your departure down to the very second, and, horrifyingly, the nature of your visit, i.e. number one or number two, and then she'd ask you to read the hall pass aloud, which listed your rights and restrictions, primarily among them that you could leave class for no more than 2 minutes, and that while gone you ascended to walk only on the right side of the corridor and go directly to the nearest bathroom, and not say a word to anyone, and not run in the halls, and not be disruptive whatsoever, and do nothing illegal while in the bathroom. Then you had to sign the hall pass and wait while Miss Bowles explained to you that you had signed a contract, and there were severe penalties for people who broke contracts. Most of the time, the kids would listen to her wide-eyed and panicked in doing that uncomfortable pee dance because they were already on the clock, and the more Miss Bowles talked about contract law, the more of their precious 2 minutes she cut into, such that when they finally got to the hall, they had maybe 90 seconds to get to the bathroom and do their business and get back to class, all without running, which was impossible. Plus, you were only allowed 2 bathroom passes per week. Then there was the rule about the water fountain. After students returned from recess, they could only drink from the water fountain for 3 seconds each. This was probably meant to teach them about cooperation and selflessness, but of course the kids were panting and exhausted after a frenzied recess, letting off all their stored-up angst, and there was a heat wave, and they were rarely allowed bathroom breaks, so the only water these sweaty and sunburned and overheated kids got all day came at the water fountain for these 3 seconds. This was a perverse double whammy for the students, because if they ran off their energy at recess, they would be parched and exhausted for the rest of the day, whereas if they didn't run around during recess, they'd feel so hyperactive in the late afternoon that they'd almost certainly get in some behavior-related trouble. So mostly the students played hard at recess, then gulped as much water as they could during their tiny 3-second interval. And by the end of the day, they were desolate, dehydrated lumps, which was actually how Miss Bowles preferred it. So she stood over them and loudly counted out their time, and each kid popped up at 3, their chins dripping, not even close to enough water on this hot and humid and terrible Midwest day. "This is bullshit," Bishop said to Samuel as they waited in line. "Watch this." And when it was Bishop's turn, he leaned over the fountain, pressed the button, and drank while making direct eye contact with Miss Bowles, who said, 1, 2, 3. Then when Bishop did not stop drinking, she said, 3, again, more pointedly. Then when Bishop still did not stop, she said, "You're done now, next." And then it became clear that Bishop was not going to stop drinking until he was good and ready. and it appeared to most of the kids in line that Bishop wasn't even drinking anymore so much as letting the water run coolly over his lips, still looking directly at Miss Bowles as she finally realized this wasn't a matter of the new kid not knowing the rules, but rather a direct challenge to her authority. And she responded to the confrontation by gathering herself into a rigid hands-on-hips, chin-jutting-out kind of posture, and her voice dropped an octave as she said, "Bishop, you will stop drinking. Now." He stared at her with this bored, lifeless expression that was just so incredible and daring, and the kids in line were already bug-eyed and giggling dementedly because Bishop was about 2 seconds away from a paddling. Anyone who so blatantly disregarded the rules got paddled. The paddle was famous. It hung on the office wall of their principal, the school's chief disciplinarian, the unfortunately named Lawrence Large, a short and oddly shaped man who carried his weight almost entirely from the waist up. His legs were skinny and frail while his upper body ballooned. He looked like an egg standing on toothpicks. One wondered how his ankles and shin bones didn't snap. His paddle was made from a single 3-inch thick slab of wood, was about as wide as 2 pieces of notebook paper put together, and had about a dozen small holes drilled into it, for aerodynamics, the kids hypothesized, so he could swing it faster. His paddlings were legendary for their force, for the technique required to generate enough power to, for example, shatter Bran Beaumont's glasses, which was a historical fact that lived on as oral history among the members of the sixth grade class. That Large struck Beaumont's ass so hard the shockwave traveled up through the poor boy's body and cracked his high-prescription lenses. Comparisons were made to professional tennis players uncoiling 140-mile-per-hour serves, how Large could transfer his weight in such a way to deliver a devastating and athletically unlikely blow. Sure, occasionally a parent might complain about the principal's retrograde punishment system, but since a paddling was the ultimate misbehavior prevention and deterrent, it was, for the most part, pretty rare. Certainly not frequent enough to spur any PTO campaigns. The absolute fact of assured backside annihilation was enough to keep even the rowdiest children in a more or less calm and low decibel and narcotized fearful stupor for the whole of the school day. That they went into spasms of wild hyperactivity as soon as they got home was something parents sometimes grumbled about to teachers, who quietly nodded their heads and thought, "Not my problem." Every teacher had a unique point at which rebelliousness would no longer be tolerated. For Miss Bowles, that moment came after 12 seconds. For 12 seconds, Bishop was at the water fountain. For 12 seconds, he stared at Miss Bowles as she demanded he move along until finally she yanked Bishop by his shirt, physically grabbed him near the neck, and with a stitch-tearing noise pulled him momentarily up off the ground before marching him toward the terrifying office of Principal Large. What typically happened when a kid came back from a paddling is that somewhere between 10 and 20 minutes after being sent away, there would be a knock on the classroom door, and Miss Bowles would open it, and there would be Principal Large with his big hand on the back of some red-faced, snotty, sniveling kid. The faces of the recently paddled were always the same, wet and grim, eyes rubbed red, runny-nosed, defeated. There was no more rebellion in them, no more bravado. Even the loudest, most attention-seeking boys looked in this moment like they wanted to curl up under their desks and die. Then Large would say, "I think this one is ready to rejoin the class." And Miss Bowles would say, "I hope he's learned his lesson." And even students as young as 11 were sophisticated enough to know that this bit of dialogue was all theater, that the adults were not talking to each other but rather to the whole lot of them, the easily grasped subtext being, "Don't step out of line or you're next." The kid would then be allowed to return to his seat, where his secondary punishment would begin, since his ass would be throbbing and bright red and tender as an open wound all over, and so sitting on the school's hard plastic chairs brought a sharp pain that felt, they said, like being paddled again. And so the kid would sit there in misery and cry, and Miss Bowles would say, "I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Do you have something to add to our discussion?" And the kid would shake his head, no, in this pathetic, broken, miserable way, and the whole class knew that Miss Bowles wanted to draw everyone's attention to his crying as a way to shame him more. In public, in front of his friends. There was a ruthlessness in Miss Bowles that the genderless blue sweaters she wore just barely contained. That day, they were all waiting for Bishop to return. They were excited. They were eager to accept him after this initiation. Now he'd know what they'd been through. He was one of them, so they waited, ready to welcome Bishop back and forgive him for crying. 10 minutes passed, then 15, and finally, right at the 18-minute mark, came the inevitable knock on the door. And Miss Bowles made a big show of saying, "Who could that be?" before putting the chalk onto the blackboard tray and striding to the door and opening it. And there they were, Bishop and Principal Large. And she was shocked, and the whole class was shocked, to see that not only was Bishop not crying, but he was also visibly smiling. He looked happy. Large's hand was not on Bishop's back. In fact, the principal was an odd 2 to 3 feet away from Bishop, as if the boy had some contagious disease. Miss Bowles stared at Principal Large for a moment, and Large did not stick to his usual script about Bishop being ready to rejoin the class, but only said, in a kind of distant way that soldiers sometimes talk about war, "Here, take him." And Bishop walked to his desk, and every kid in the class watched him go and sit down, jumping into his seat and landing hard on his butt and looking up fiercely, as if to challenge anyone to try to hurt him. It was a moment that lived in the heart of every sixth grader who saw it. One of their own had taken the worst of the adult world and come out victorious. Nobody ever fucked with Bishop Fall after that. 5. Samuel's mother told him about the Nix, another of her father's ghosts, the scariest one. The Nix, she said, was a spirit of the water who flew up and down the coastline looking for children, especially adventurous children out walking alone. When it found one, the Nix would appear to the child as a large white horse, unsaddled but friendly and tame. It bowed down as low as a horse was able so the kid could leap onto it. At first the children were afraid, but ultimately how could they refuse their very own horse? They jumped on, and when it stood up again they were 8 feet off the ground and they were delighted. Nothing this big had ever minded them before. They became bold. They would kick at the horse to go faster, and so it broke into a light trot, and the more the kids loved it, the faster the horse would go. Then they wanted other people to see them. They wanted their friends to stare with envy at this brand new horse, their horse. It always went like this. The kids who were victims of the Nix always felt, at first, fear, then luck, then possession, then pride, then terror. They'd kick at the horse to go faster until it was in a full gallop, the kids hanging on to its neck. It was the best thing that had ever happened to them. They'd never felt so important, so full of pleasure, and only at this point, at the pinnacle of speed and joy, when they felt most in control of the horse, when they felt the most ownership of it, when they most wanted to be celebrated for it and thus felt the most vanity and arrogance and pride, would the horse veer off the road that led to town and gallop toward the cliffs overlooking the sea. It ran full bore toward that great drop into the violent, churning water below, and the kids screamed and yanked back on the horse's mane and cried and wailed, but nothing mattered. The horse leaped off the cliff and dropped. The children clung to its neck even as they fell, and if they weren't bashed to death on the rocks, they drowned in the frigid water. This was a story Faye had heard from her father. All her ghost stories came from Grandpa Frank, who was a tall and thin and intensely withdrawn man with a perplexing accent. Most people found him intimidating in his silence, but Samuel always thought it was a relief. Whenever they visited him in Iowa on those rare Thanksgivings or Christmases, the family would sit around the table eating and not saying a word. It was hard to have a conversation when it was met only with a nod of his head, a dismissive, "Hmm." Mostly they ate their turkey until Grandpa Frank was finished eating and left to watch television in the other room. The only time Grandpa Frank was ever really animated was when he told them stories of the old country, old myths, old legends, old tales about ghosts he'd heard growing up where he'd grown up, in far north Norway, in a little fishing village in the Arctic that he left when he was 18. When he told Faye about the Nix, he said the moral was, "Don't trust things that are too good to be true." Then she grew up and came to a new conclusion, which she told Samuel in the month before leaving the family. She told him the same story but added her own moral. "The things you love the most will one day hurt you the worst." Samuel didn't understand. The Nyx doesn't appear as a horse anymore, she said. They were in the kitchen hoping for a break in the heat wave that now seemed endless, sitting there reading with the refrigerator door wide open and a fan blowing the cold air onto them, drinking ice water, glasses sweating wet circles on the table. The Nyx used to appear as a horse, she said, but that was in the old days. What does it look like now? It's different for everyone, but it usually appears as a person. Usually it's someone you think you love. Samuel still did not understand. People love each other for many reasons, not all of them good, she said. They love each other because it's easy, or because they're used to it, or because they've given up, or because they're scared. People can be a Nyx for each other. She sipped her water, then pressed the cold glass to her forehead. She closed her eyes. It was a long, tedious Saturday afternoon. Henry had gone into the office after another one of their fights, this one on the issue of dirty dishes. Their late 70s-era avocado-colored dishwasher had finally stopped working this week, and not once had Henry volunteered to clean the growing pile of plates and bowls and cookware and glasses that had overrun the sink and much of the counter. Samuel suspected his mother was intentionally letting the pile get out of hand, maybe even contributing to it more than usual, using several pots for a meal that probably required only one, as a kind of test. Would Henry notice? Would he help? That he did neither of these things was something she extrapolated great meaning from. "It's like home ec class all over again," she told him when the pile finally became unbearable.
"What are you talking about?" Henry said.
"Just like in high school. You go have fun while I cook and clean. Nothing's changed. In 20 years, absolutely nothing has changed."
Henry washed all the dishes, then claimed urgent weekend duties at the office, leaving Faye and Samuel alone, together. Again. They sat in the kitchen and read from their respective books. Incomprehensible poetry for her. Choose your own adventure for him.
"I knew a girl named Margaret in high school," they said. "Margaret was a very bright and witty girl. And in school she fell in love with a boy named Jules. A handsome boy who could do anything. Everyone was jealous of her. But it turns out Jules was her Nyx."
"Why? What happened?" She set her glass in the puddle it had made on the wood.
"He disappeared," she said. "She got stranded, never left town. I hear she's still there, working as a cashier at her dad's pharmacy."
"Why did he do that?"
"That's what a Nyx does."
She couldn't tell?
"It's difficult to see. But a good rule to remember is that anyone you fall in love with before you're an adult is probably a Nyx."
"Anyone?"
"Probably anyone."
"When did you meet Dad?"
"In school," she said. "We were 17.
Faye stared into the yellow haze of the day. The refrigerator chugged and hummed and clicked, and all at once, with a brief final electrical zap, it quit. And the light went out, and the countertop digital clock radio died. And Faye looked around and said,
"We blew a fuse."
Which meant, of course, that Samuel had to flip the breaker because the breaker box was in the basement and his mother refused to go into the basement. The flashlight was heavy and solid in his hand, its aluminum handle dimpled, its big round rubberized face an appropriate size for striking something violently in a pinch. His mother didn't go into the basement because the basement was where the house spirit lived. At least that was the story, another one from his grandfather. House spirits that inhabit basements and haunt you your entire life. His mother said she'd encountered one as a child and gotten spooked. She never liked basements after that. But she insisted that her house spirit appeared only to her, only she was haunted, and Samuel was perfectly safe. He could go into the basement unharmed. He began to cry. A soft and light whimper, because either there was a cruel ghost living in the basement watching him at this very moment, or his mother was a little crazy. He shuffled his feet along the concrete floor, and kept his attention narrowly focused on the beam of light in front of him. He tried to be blind to everything but that circle of light, and when he finally did see the fuse box on the other side of the room, he shut his eyes and walked as straight as he could. He shuffled forward and stuck the flashlight out in front of him, and continued in this manner until he felt the flashlight's face bump into the wall. He opened his eyes. There was the fuse box. He threw the breaker and the basement lights came alive. He looked behind him and saw nothing. Nothing but the ordinary basement junk. He stayed a moment to collect himself, to stop crying. He sat on the floor. It was so much cooler down here.
6. In those first few weeks of the school year, Bishop and Samuel fell into an easy alliance. Bishop would do whatever he wanted, and Samuel would follow. These were simple roles for the both of them. They never even discussed or acknowledged it, but fell into their positions like coins falling into their slots in a vending machine. They'd meet in the woods for war games near the pond. Bishop always had a scenario ready for their games. They fought Charlie in Vietnam, the Nazis in World War II, the Confederacy in the Civil War, the British in the Revolutionary War, the Indians in the French and Indian War. And with the exception of their one confused attempt to play War of 1812, the wars always had a clear objective, and they were always the good guys, and their enemies were always bad, and the two of them always won. Or if they weren't playing war, they'd play video games at Bishop's house, which was Samuel's preference because then he might run into Bethany, whom he loved. Though he probably wouldn't have called it love just yet, it was rather a state of heightened attention and agitation that manifested itself physically as a smaller vocal dynamic range. He had a tendency to shut down and become penitent in her presence, even though he did not mean to or want to. And an intense desire to touch her clothes between his thumb and forefinger, lightly. Bishop's sister exhilarated him and terrified him, but she usually ignored them. Bethany seemed unaware of her influence. She practiced her scales, listened to music, closed her door. She traveled to various music festivals and competitions where she won solo violin ribbons and trophies that eventually went up on her bedroom wall, along with her various posters of Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals and a small collection of those porcelain masks representing comedy and tragedy. Dried flowers, too, from her many recitals, when afterward she was given big bouquets of roses that she carefully dried and then affixed to her wall above her bed, an efflorescence of pastel greens and pinks that exactly matched her bedspread and curtains and wallpaper color scheme. It was such a girl's room. Samuel knew this bedroom because he had, 2 or 3 times, spied on it from a safe position outside in the woods. He left his house right after sunset, under a deepening violet sky, came down to the creek, and made his muddy way through the woods, behind the houses of Venetian Village, past the gardens where roses and violets were closing up for the night, behind the odorous dog kennels and greenhouses that smelled of sulfur and phosphorus, behind the house of the headmaster of Blessed Heart Academy, who could sometimes be found this time of night relaxing in his custom-built outdoor saltwater jacuzzi. And Samuel would move cautiously and slowly and watch out not to step on twigs or piles of dead leaves while he kept one eye on the headmaster, who from this distance looked like an indistinct white blobby thing, the many parts of him, belly and chin and underarms, notable only for their heavy sag. And on around the block, through the woods, down to the street's stubby end, where Samuel took a position among the tree roots behind the fall house, perhaps 10 feet from where the lawn met the forest, dressed entirely in black, with a black hood pulled down to within an inch of the ground, so that the only bits of body that he showed the world were his eyes. And there, he watched. The yellow-orange glow of lights, shadows of people as they migrated through the house. And when Bethany appeared within the frame of her bedroom window, a bolt of anxiety cracked in his belly. He pressed into the ground harder. She wore a thin cotton dress, which is what she always wore, always a little classier than anyone else, like she was returning from a fancy restaurant or church. The way the dress slightly swung as she walked, and then the way it so softly came to rest against her body when she stopped moving, gliding back down to her skin, like watching feathers fall elegantly through the air. Samuel could drown in that fabric, happily. All he wanted was to see her, just a confirmation that she did, in fact, exist. That's all he needed. And upon seeing her, he would soon leave, long before she changed clothes, and he could be accused of doing something dishonorable. Just this one thing, seeing Bethany and sharing this quiet,
private moment with her could calm him, get him through another week. That she attended Blessed Heart and not the public school, that she spent so much time in her room and so much time traveling, struck Samuel as unfair and unjust. The girls the other boys loved were always present, right there in front of them in class, right there next to them in the cafeteria. That Bethany was so inaccessible meant to Samuel in his head that he was justified in occasionally spying on her. He was owed. Then one day he was at their house when she walked right into the TV room while Bishop played Nintendo and collapsed into the same extra-large beanbag chair Samuel was at that moment sitting in. She sat in such a way that a small portion of her shoulder pressed against a small portion of his shoulder, and suddenly he felt that all the meaning in the world was concentrated in those few square inches. "I'm bored," she said. She wore a yellow sundress. Samuel could smell her shampoo, rich with honey and lemon and vanilla. He held himself still, afraid that if he moved, she might leave. "Want a turn?" Bishop said, shoving the controller toward her.
"No."
"Want to play hide-and-seek?"
"No."
"Kick the can, Red Rover?"
"How can we play Red Rover?"
"Just throwing out ideas here. Brainstorming. Spitballing."
"I don't want to play Red Rover."
"Hopscotch? Tiddlywinks?"
"Now you're being stupid."
Samuel felt his shoulder sweating where Bethany's shoulder pressed into him. He was so rigid it hurt. "Or those weird games girls play," Bishop said, "where they fold up pieces of paper to find out who you're going to marry and how many babies you'll have."
"I do not want to do that."
"Don't you want to know how many babies you'll have? 11 babies, that's my guess."
"Shut up."
"We could play Dare."
"I don't want to play Dare."
"What's Dare?" Samuel said. "It's truth or dare without the bullshit," Bishop said.
"I want to go somewhere," Bethany said, "for absolutely no reason. I want to go somewhere just for the point of being there and not here."
"The park?" Bishop said. "The beach? Egypt?"
"For no other reason than to be at a place for no reason."
"Oh," Bishop said. "You want to go to the mall?"
"Yes," she said. "The mall. Yes, I do."
"I'm going to the mall," Samuel said.
"Our parents won't take us to the mall," Bethany said. "They say it's cheap and vulgar."
"I wouldn't be caught dead wearing those clothes," Bishop said, puffing his chest out and doing his best impression of his father.
"I'm going to the mall tomorrow," Samuel said, "with my mom. We have to buy a new dishwasher. I'll get you something. What do you want?"
Bethany thought about it. She looked toward the ceiling and tapped her finger on her cheekbone and thought about it hard and long before saying, "Surprise me."
And all that night and into the following day, Samuel thought about what he could buy for Bethany. What gift would capture everything he needed to let her know? The gift needed to distill his feelings for her, give her in one small package a quick, potent shot of his love and commitment and total helpless devotion. So he knew the gift's parameters, but he could not see the gift itself. Somewhere in the mall's million-billion shelves, the perfect gift almost certainly waited for him. But what was it? In the car, Samuel was quiet, and his mother was agitated. She always got like this on their trips to the mall. She loathed the mall, and so her critiques of what she called suburban mall culture grew severe and brutal whenever she actually had to go there. They navigated out of the subdivision onto the wider arterial road that looked like any arterial road in any American suburb, a franchise hall of mirrors. "This is what you get in the suburbs," his mother said, "the satisfaction of small desires, the getting of things you didn't even know you wanted. An even larger grocery store, a fourth lane, a bigger, better parking lot, a new sandwich shop or video rental store, a McDonald's slightly closer than the other McDonald's, a McDonald's next door to a Burger King, across the street from a Hardee's, in the same lot as a Steak and Shake, and a Bonanza, and a Ponderosa all-you-can-eat smorgasbord thing. What you get, in other words, is choice." "Or rather, the illusion of choice," she said. "All these restaurants offering substantially the same menu, some slight variation on potatoes and beef." Like at the grocery store when she stood in the pasta aisle looking at the 18 different brands of spaghetti. "She couldn't understand, why do we need 18 spaghetti?" she said. Samuel shrugged. "Exactly," she said. "Why did we need 20 different coffees? Why did we need so many shampoos? It was easy to forget when looking at the chaos of the cereal aisle that all these hundreds of options were actually one option. At the mall, the tremendous, bright, vast, air-conditioned cathedral of a mall, they were looking at dishwashers. But Faye was distracted by various other home appliances, something that made it easier to store leftover food, something that made it easier to grind it up, something that prevented food from sticking to the pan, something that made it easier to freeze food, something that made it easier to warm it up again. When she looked at each item, she clucked a surprise, "Huh," and inspected it, turned it over in her hand, read the box, and said, "I wonder who thought of this." She was wary around these things, suspicious that someone else had created a need in her or had identified a need she didn't know she had. In the home and garden section, it was a self-propelled lawnmower that got her attention, bright and macho big and fantastically shiny red. "I never even thought I'd have a lawn," she said, "and yet I suddenly want this very badly. Is that wrong?" "No, it's not wrong," she said later, in one of the mall's other kitchen stores, picking up the conversation as if she'd never stopped talking. "There's nothing wrong with it at all. But I don't know. I feel like..." She paused, held some white plastic object in her hand, stared at it, some device that achieved perfectly julienne vegetables. "Doesn't it seem absurd that I can just buy this? I don't know. Is this really me?" she said, staring at the thing cupped in her hand. "The real me. Is this who I've become?" "Can I have some money?" Samuel said. "For what?" Samuel shrugged. "Don't just buy something to buy it for the point of buying something." "I won't." "You don't have to buy something, is my point. Nobody really needs any of this stuff." She reached into her purse and produced a $10 bill. "Meet me back here in an hour." He gripped the money in his hand and marched off into the mall's blazing white light. The place was unknowably large. It was like a big, breathing animal. The sound of a child or children somewhere distant yelling or crying became part of the omnidirectional din. Samuel had no idea where it was coming from, where the child was, whether the child was happy or sad. It was simply a disconnected audio fact. It was inconceivable that there were not enough stores at the mall, but someone decided there needed to be even more, thus the small, standalone kiosks that occupied the middle of every thoroughfare, selling specialized and sometimes gimmicky merchandise. Little toy helicopters that the salesman demonstrated by flying them over the crowd's worried heads. Keychains with your name laser engraved onto them. Special hair curler things Samuel couldn't begin to understand. Sausages in gift boxes. Blocks of glass that appeared to have 3D holograms inside, a special girdle that made you look thinner than you really were, hats embroidered with personalized messages while you waited, T-shirts laser-printed with your own photographs. With its hundreds of stores and booths, the mall seemed to make a simple promise that here you would find everything you needed. Even seemingly esoteric things could be found here. Teeth whitening, for example, seemed like an unlikely mall purchase. Or Swedish massage. Or a piano. And yet you could find them all here. The mall's overwhelmingness was meant to replace your imagination. Forget trying to dream up your desires. The mall had already dreamed them up for you. Trying to find the perfect gift in the mall was like reading a choose-your-own-adventure book when the choices were absent. He had to guess which page to turn to. The happy ending was out there somewhere, hidden. Samuel walked by the candle store and breathed one or two lungfuls of its cinnamon odor. The nail salon gave him a momentary toxic headache. The candy store's plastic bins of jawbreakers called to him, but he resisted. The mall's music mixed with the music coming from each of the stores, the effect being like a car going into and out of radio coverage. Songs faded in, faded out. Earlier they were playing something happily Motown. Now they were playing The Twist, Chubby Checker, one of his mother's least favorite songs, a fact Samuel didn't know how he knew. And he was considering the music and listening to the music coming out of the stores, and he actually saw the music store across the food court before the idea finally struck. And he couldn't believe it had taken him this long to come to it. Music. Bethany was a musician. He ran to the store and felt embarrassed that in all this time he'd been asking himself what he could give her without asking himself what she might actually want. And this felt egotistical and selfish, and definitely something he'd have to work on personally some other time, when he didn't have to find the perfect gift in like 10 minutes. So he ran into the store and was briefly disheartened when he saw that all the popular cassette tapes were around $12, and thus outside his budget. But this despair did not last long, because at the back of the store he spotted a bin labeled Classical Music, and below that, Half Off, which felt like providence. The cassettes here were $6, and one of them, he was sure of it, was the perfect gift. But as Samuel rifled through the clacking, disordered chaos of the clearance bin, he encountered a fundamental problem. He didn't know any of this music. He didn't know what Bethany would like, what she already owned. He didn't even know what was good. Some of the names were familiar, Beethoven, Mozart, but most were not. Some were unpronounceably foreign, and he was about to go with one of the famous names he'd heard before, Stravinsky, though he couldn't remember why he knew it, when he decided that if he'd heard of Stravinsky, then Bethany almost assuredly already owned every Stravinsky recording and was probably by now bored with them. And so he resolved to find something more modern, interesting, new, something that advertised his fascinating tastes and showed how he was different and independent and didn't follow the herd like everyone else. So he picked out the 10 most interesting-looking covers. Nothing with the portrait of the composer, nothing with an old painting or a photograph of a stuffy-looking orchestra, nothing with a conductor holding a baton. He went for the conceptual stuff. Splashy colors, abstract geometric shapes, psychedelic spirals. He brought them to the counter and piled them in front of the cashier and asked, "Which of these would no one ever buy?" The cashier, a sensitive-looking 30-something assistant manager guy with a ponytail, did not act like this was an odd question, but rather looked through the cassettes dutifully and then, with an air of authority that made Samuel trust him, picked one and shook it and said, "This one. No one ever buys this one." Samuel put down his $10 and the cashier wrapped the cassette in the bag. "This is really modern stuff," the cashier said. "Really out there." "Good," Samuel said. "It's the same piece recorded 10 different times, like really weird stuff. You like this?" "Very much." "Okay," he said. He gave him his change, and Samuel still had about $4 left. He ran to the candy store. The perfect gift swung wildly in its bag and battered the back of his legs, and his mouth puckered in anticipation of the jawbreaker he was going to buy. And his head bounced to the mall's music, and his eyes fluttered with daydreams, where he made the right choice every time, and all his adventures had the very best and happiest endings. 7. Bishop Fall was a bully, but not an obvious bully. He did not prey on the weak. He left them alone, the skinny boys, the awkward girls. He wanted nothing easy. It was the strong and confident and self-possessed and powerful who drew his attention. During the school year's first pep rally, Bishop took an interest in Andy Berg, resident champion of all things brutal, only member of the sixth grade class to achieve dark growths of leg and underarm hair, local terrorizer of the small and shrill. It was the gym teacher who first started calling him Iceberg, or sometimes just the Berg, because of his size, colossal, speed, slow, and the way he moved, unstoppably. The Berg was your typical grade school bully, vastly bigger and stronger than anyone else in class, and transparently externalizing some raging inner demons about his stunted mental abilities, which were the only things stunted about him. The rest of his body was on some kind of genetic sprint to adulthood. He was now, in sixth grade, taller than the female teachers, heavier too. His body was not one of those destined for athletic greatness. He was simply going to be thick. A torso shaped like a beer keg, arms like beef flanks. The pep rally began as it usually did, with grades 1 through 6 sitting in the bleachers of the odd-smelling rubber-floored gymnasium, watching assistant principal Terry Fluster, who, by the way, was dressed as a 6-foot-tall red-and-white eagle, the school's mascot, lead them through a series of cheers, beginning as always with, "Eagles, don't do drugs!" Then Principal Large shushed them and gave his typical inaugural spiel about his expectations for behavior and his zero-tolerance, no-shit-taking teaching philosophy, during which the students stopped paying attention and stared narcoleptically at their shoes. Save for the first graders, who were hearing this for the first time and were, naturally, terrified. The pep rally concluded with Mr. Fluster's usual, "Let's go, Eagles! Let's go, Eagles!" And the students yelled and clapped along with him at a level that was roughly one-quarter of the assistant principal's enthusiasm, still loud enough to mask Andy Berg's individual cheer, which was audible only to the several people standing around him, Samuel and Bishop included.
"Kim's a faggot! Kim's a faggot!"
Directed, of course, at poor Kim Wigley, standing two paces to the Berg's left, by all accounts the easiest boy to make fun of in the entire sixth-grade class. One of those kids suffering through every prepubescent disaster there was. Thick snowy dandruff, aggressive braces, chronic impetigo, extreme nearsightedness, severe allergies to nuts and pollen, destabilizing ear infections, facial eczema, bimonthly pink eye, warts, asthma, even an occurrence of head lice in the second grade that no one ever let him forget. Plus, he was all of about 40 pounds soaking wet. Plus, he had a girl's first name. In these moments, Samuel knew the right thing to do would be to defend Kim and stop the bullying and stand up to the giant Andy Berg, because bullies back down when they encounter resistance, according to the brochures they were given in health class once a year. This was, everyone knew, a big fat lie. Because last year, Brand Beaumont actually did stand up to the Berg for the constant scorn directed toward Brand's bulletproof thick eyeglasses, stood up to him right in the middle of the lunchroom and said, "Shut up your big mouth, you big jerk!" in a spasm of nervous agitation. And the Berg did indeed back down and left him alone the rest of the school day, and everyone who witnessed it was jubilant because maybe they were safe now. And maybe the pamphlets were right, and this great sense of optimism pervaded the school, and Brand was a minor hero, until the Berg found him on his way home that day and beat him up so savagely that the police actually got involved and interviewed Brand's friends, who, by now, had learned an important lesson: to keep their fucking mouths shut. Bullies do not back down. The big rumor about the Berg this year, one propagated by the Berg himself, was that he was, by all accounts, the first member of the sixth grade class to have sex. With a girl. With, he said, a former babysitter who, quote, "can't get enough of my dick." This, of course, was unverifiable. Either the high school girl in question or her interest in the Berg's anatomy. Unverifiable, but also unchallenged. Nobody in the locker room within earshot of the Berg's boasting was willing to risk personal injury by stating the obvious. There was no way a high school girl would be interested in a sixth grader unless she was mentally disturbed, wicked ugly, or emotionally broken. Or all three of these things. There was just no way. And yet, there was something in the way the Berg spoke about sex that made the boys wonder. It was the specificity of the details. The exact and totally unglamorous particulars. That's what gave the boys pause, kept them up at night wondering and sometimes falling into private rages that maybe he was telling the truth. Maybe he really was banging a high schooler. And if this was true, it was the only proof they needed that the world was unjust and that God did not exist. Or if God did exist, God must hate them, for nobody in the school deserves sex less than Andy fucking Berg. Every gym class they endured it. How he had to smoke one of his dad's cigars to cover the smell of pussy. How he wasn't getting laid this week because the girl was on the rag. How one time when he blew his load, the condom he was wearing exploded because he was just that horny. These visions gave the boys nightmares. These and the larger tragedy that the repellent Andy Berg was having robust sex while most of them had only very recently had the talk with their parents, and the whole idea of sex with a girl still seemed terrifying and gross. It might have been the way the Berg taunted Kim at the pep rally that prompted Bishop to act. He would have thought it was too easy, too obvious, the way Kim didn't fight back, how his passive and slumped-over body revealed his 100% acceptance of the hierarchies at work here. Kim stood there reflexively prepared to be bullied. The shooting fish-in-a-barrel nature of this probably outraged Bishop's odd sense of justice, his soldier's desire to protect the weak and innocent via disproportionate violence. As all the students filed out of the gymnasium, Bishop tapped the Berg on the shoulder.
"I heard a rumor about you," he said.
The Berg looked down at him, annoyed.
"Yeah?
What?"
"That you've had sex."
"You better fucking believe it,"
It's true then, the rumor.
I get so much pussy you don't even know how much.
Samuel trailed carefully behind them. He was not usually comfortable being this close to the Berg, but with Bishop between them he felt safe. Bishop's personality tended to direct all attention to him. It was as if Bishop blocked Samuel from view.
Okay, Bishop said. I have something for you.
What?
It's something for people who are a little more mature, such as yourself.
What is it?
I don't want to say right now. Someone might hear. And this is very juicy, really illegal stuff we're talking about.
What the fuck are you saying?
Bishop rolled his eyes and looked around as if to check if anyone was eavesdropping before leaning closer to the Berg and beckoning him with his fingers to lean down so that his giant head wasn't so far away, and Bishop whispered,
"Pornography." No way!
Quiet down. You've got porn?
A massive stash.
Seriously?
I've been trying to decide who here has grown up enough to see it.
Rad!
The Berg said, roused. Because for kids his age, for kids hitting adolescence in the 80s, in those days before the internet, before the web made pornography easily accessible and therefore banal, for this last generation of boys for whom porn was primarily a physical object, possessing pornography was like having a superpower, one that made you immediately legitimate and popular among the other boys. This happened roughly once per semester, some obscure boy locating his father's collection of dirty magazines and suddenly finding himself elevated socially for as long as he didn't get in trouble, which might take a day to several months depending on the constitution of the boy. The ones who were transparently desperate and begging for attention and craving to be liked tended to steal the whole pile in exchange for a one-time flash of celebrity. Bright stars who burned out in a day when their fathers noticed the disappearance of all their pornography and put two and two together. Other boys, the ones with more impulse control and less desperation for approval, were more judicious in their porn approaches. They might remove only one magazine from the pile, say the second or third from the bottom, an edition that had presumably been perused, enjoyed, digested, and abandoned. They brought that one magazine to school and let everyone look through it before replacing it in the pile a week or two later, then removing another edition from near the bottom and then repeating the pattern. These boys maintained a consistent popularity for sometimes months before a teacher noticed a group of boys sitting still in a huddle on the playground and came to investigate. Because when grade school boys weren't running around like spazzes, it meant something was definitely wrong. It was always temporary, in other words, the boys' access to porn, which was why it so piqued the Berg's interest.
"Where is it?" he said.
"Most of these kids would freak out," Bishop said. "They wouldn't understand what they're looking at."
"Let me see it."
"You, on the other hand, I think you could handle it."
"Damn right."
"Okay, meet me after school, after everyone's left the building, at the stairwell behind the cafeteria by the loading dock. I'll show you where I hide it."
The Berg agreed, then pushed his way out of the gymnasium. Samuel tapped Bishop on the shoulder.
"What are you doing?" he said. Bishop smiled.
"I'm taking the fight to the enemy."
Later that day, after the final bell, after the buses had come and gone and the building had emptied, Bishop and Samuel waited behind the school, that part of the school not visible from the road, all concrete and asphalt. It had the look of a regional high-volume shipping facility, industrial and mechanical and automated and apocalyptic. There were massive air conditioning units whose fans spun inside aluminum shells crusted and emblackened with sooty exhaust, roaring like a squadron of attack helicopters readying for but never quite managing takeoff. There were scraps of paper and cardboard blown by the wind into corners and crevices. There was the industrial trash compactor, solid metal, the size of a dump truck, painted that forest green color typical of waste disposal vehicles, covered all over with a scum of sticky trash residue. Just next to the loading dock was a stairwell that led down to a basement door nobody ever used. Nobody even knew where it led. The stairwell was enclosed on one side by the concrete wall of the loading dock, on the other by tall, unclimbable vertical bars. There was also a gate at the top of the stairs. This stairwell was a riddle for anyone who bothered thinking about it long enough. The bars obviously communicated a desire to keep people out except that even if the gate were locked, it would be a simple matter to leap down into the stairwell from the loading dock above it. But the basement door at the bottom of the stairs was one of those that opened only from the inside and didn't even have an exterior handle, so the only real function of the gate was to trap people in, which seemed at least architecturally odd and at most an extreme hazard in the event of fire. Anyway, the amount of dirt and dead leaves and thrown away plastic wrappers and cigarette butts in the stairwell indicated that it hadn't been used in years. They waited for the burg here, Samuel feeling scared and nervous about this whole thing, about what Bishop planned to do, which was to lock any burg in the stairwell and leave him there all night.
"I really don't think we should be doing this,"
he told Bishop, who was at the bottom of the stairwell hiding a black plastic bag he had produced from his backpack, burying it under the leaves and dirt and debris.
"Relax," he said. "It'll be fine."
"But what if it isn't?" said Samuel, who was right on the cusp of a Category 2 just thinking about the ways Andy Berg could get them back for what seemed like a pretty stupid trick.
"Let's just go right now," Samuel said, "before he gets here. No harm done."
"I need you to do your job. What's your job?"
Samuel frowned and touched the bulky metal padlock he was currently hiding in his pocket.
"When he gets to the bottom of the steps, close the gate."
"Quietly close the gate,"
Bishop said.
"Right, so he doesn't notice." "I'll give you the signal and you'll close the gate."
"What's the signal?"
"I'll give you a look pregnant with meaning."
"A what?"
"A real bug-eyed look. You'll know it when you see it."
"Okay.
And after the gate is closed?"
"I lock it," Samuel said.
"That's the essential part of the mission."
"I know."
"The very most important part.
If I lock it, then he can't get out and beat us up."
"You have to think like a soldier here. You have to be focused on your part of the operation."
"Okay."
"I didn't hear you."
Samuel kicked at the ground. "I said hooah." "That's better." It was warm and wetly humid, the shadows lengthening and the light a deep orange. Storm clouds gathered on the horizon, those great Midwestern clouds like floating avalanches, which meant an evening of thundershowers and heat lightning. The wind blew roughly through the trees. A tang of electricity and ozone in the air. Bishop finished arranging the bag at the bottom of the stairs. Samuel practiced closing the gate without making it squeak. Eventually, they climbed up onto the loading dock and waited, Bishop checking and rechecking the contents of his backpack, Samuel fingering the ridges of the heavy padlock in his pocket.
"Hey, Bish?"
"Yeah?"
"What happened in the principal's office?"
"What do you mean?"
"When you went for a paddling, what happened in there?"
Bishop stopped fussing with his backpack for a moment. He looked at Samuel, then away, off into the distance. He assumed a certain manner Samuel had begun to recognize, where his body seemed coiled and tightened, and his eyes turned to slits and his eyebrows wrinkled into check marks. A posture of defiance, a look Samuel had seen before, with the principal and Miss Bowles and Mr. Fall, and when Bishop threw that rock at the headmaster's house. It was a fierceness and hardness usually foreign to 11-year-olds. But it dissolved just as quickly, as Andy Berg rounded the corner of the building, lumbering in his big, stupid way, shuffling along, dragging his toes like his feet were too far away from his tiny brain, as if his body were too large for his nervous system to handle.
"He's here,"
Bishop said.
"Get ready."
The Berg wore his usual uniform of black sweatpants, generic white sneakers, and a t-shirt with something juvenilely funny written on it. This time, "Where's the beef?" He was the only male in the class not made fun of for wearing imitation off-brand shoes. His giant size and proclivity to violence gave him a free pass, fashion-wise. The only acknowledgement he made to current tastes was the rat tail he grew, a hairstyle that was in vogue with roughly a quarter of the boys in the class. A proper rat tail was achieved when a boy cut his hair short but left a spot in the very middle of the back of his head to grow wildly away. The Berg had so far achieved a frizzy black curly rope that extended several inches down his neck and back. He approached the loading dock where the two boys sat, elevated, slightly above him, cross-legged.
"You came,"
Bishop said.
"Let's see it, fag.
First tell me you're not going to freak out."
"Shut the fuck up.
A lot of kids freak out. They're not mature enough. This is hardcore stuff."
"I can handle it,"
Oh, can you? Bishop said. His tone was playful and sarcastic. That tone where you can't decide if he's having fun with you or insulting you. That tone that makes you feel like you're one or two steps behind him. The understanding of this registered on the Berg's face. He hesitated, unsure of himself. He was not accustomed to kids showing any kind of spirit or spine.
Okay, let's say you can handle it, Bishop continued. Let's say you're not going to freak out. Nothing you haven't seen before, am I right?
The Berg nodded.
Because you see it all the time, right? That high schooler you're banging.
What about her?
I'm wondering why you're so eager right now when you have a girl whenever you want her. Why do you need the porn?
I don't need it.
And yet, here you are.
You don't even have it. You're lying.
Makes me think maybe there's something you're not telling us. Maybe the girl's ugly. Maybe she doesn't exist.
Fuck you. Are you going to show me this shit or not?
Okay, I'll let you see one picture. And if you don't freak out, I'll let you see the rest.
Bishop rummaged in his backpack for a moment before pulling out a page from a magazine, folded several times, one ragged edge where it had been torn free. He handed it, carefully, slowly, to the Berg, who snatched it, annoyed at Bishop's manner, his theatricality. The Berg unfolded it, and even before it was fully undone, his eyes seemed to open wider, his lips very slightly parted, and his face melted from its usual barbaric severity to a kind of giddiness.
"Whoa," he said. "Oh, yes."
Samuel could not see the image that delighted the Berg so much. He could only see the back of the page, which appeared to be an advertisement for some kind of brown liquor.
"That is awesome," the Berg said.
He looked like a puppy staring at your food.
"It's good," Bishop said, "but I wouldn't call it awesome. Actually, it's pretty par for the course. Even a little droll, if you ask me."
"Where'd you get it?"
"Irrelevant. Would you like to see more?"
"Fuck yeah."
"And you're not going to tell anyone?"
"Where is it?"
"You need to promise you won't tell."
"Fine, I promise."
"Say it with feeling."
"Just show me."
Bishop raised his hands in an "I give up" gesture, then pointed at the stairwell below him.
"Down there," he said. "I keep them down there, hidden in the dirt, bottom of the stairs."
The Berg dropped the page he was looking at and opened the gate to the stairwell and rushed down. Bishop looked at Samuel and nodded. The signal. Samuel leaped off the loading dock down to the spot where the Berg had been standing. He walked over to the gate and very slowly shut it, just as they had practiced. He could see the Berg at the bottom of the stairs, his long, horrible rat tail, the fat expanse of his back as he huddled down and swept away the dirt and leaves and discovered the plastic bag that Bishop had planted there.
"In here? In the bag?"
the Berg said.
"Yep, that's it."
When the gate shut, it did so with a small and trivial click. Samuel slipped the heavy padlock between the bars and closed it. The snap made by the lock's internal metal mechanism felt substantial and satisfying. It felt final, irrevocable. They had done it. There was no going back. A few feet away, fluttering in the wind, was the page Bishop had given the Berg. It spun in the eddies the breeze made around the loading dock, folding over itself at the creases made when it was pressed into eighths. Samuel grabbed it, opened it. And the immediate impression the photo gave, before all its shapes resolved themselves into recognizable human forms, the dominant textural feature, the thing that seemed to define the photo and would later be pretty much the only thing Samuel remembered about it, was hair. Loads of dark, curly hair. Around the girl's head, a jet-black cascade that looked physically heavy and difficult to bear, hair in tight curls that reached all the way down to the dirt she sat on, the flesh of her butt smooshing out beneath her like bread dough, one arm behind her and supporting herself with her elbow in the dirt, the other hand reaching down to her crotch, opening herself up with two fingers in a gesture that looked like an upside-down peace sign, revealing this plump and mysterious bright red spot amid another outbreak of dark black hair. Hair that was thick and curly where it almost reached her belly button, but became wispy inside her pimpled thighs, where the hair resembled the desolate attempts teenagers make at mustaches and beards.
hair that kept creeping down beneath her to the spot where she contacted the ground, where she sat in some anonymous tropical forest scene, Samuel seeing this and trying to gather all of it simultaneously and trying to make sense of it and trying to enjoy it the way Andy Berg seemed to enjoy it, but achieving only this abstract sense of curiosity combined with maybe a mild revulsion or horror that the adult world seemed to be a terrible, appalling place. He folded the page into small squares. He was trying to forcibly forget what he'd just seen when, from the bottom of the stairwell, the Berg suddenly boomed, "What the fuck?" And at that moment, a bright white flash popped. Bishop held a Polaroid camera, and it buzzed and clicked and ejected a white square of film. "What the fuck?" the Berg said again. Samuel climbed the ladder onto the loading dock and ran to the edge where Bishop stood, overlooking the Berg and flapping the photo and laughing. The Berg had several pictures around him, presumably having upended the bag and let them all flutter out. And almost all of them, Samuel could see now, were close-ups of large, erect penises. Adult penises. Adult and very manly and horribly engorged and darkly empurpled and some of them dribbling and wet. Penises, some of them from glossy magazines, some actual real Polaroid pictures, whitely lit, softly focused, close-up anonymous disembodied cocks emerging from shadows or from beneath the folds of someone's sagging belly flesh. "What the fuck?" Andy Berg could not seem to find any other words but these. "What in the fuck?"
"See? I knew it," Bishop said. "You're freaking out. What the fuck is this?" "You're not quite mature enough." "I'm going to fucking kill you. You're not quite there yet, developmentally speaking."
The Berg took the stairs two at a time. He was so big and he moved so destructively that it seemed impossible to contain him. Had they really trusted a stupid little padlock to keep them safe? Samuel imagined it snapping in half. He imagined the Berg erupting out of his cage like an insane circus animal. Samuel took a step back and stood behind Bishop, put a hand on Bishop's shoulder. The Berg ran to the top of the stairs and reached his arm forward to push open the gate. Only the gate did not budge, and the force of the Berg's huge momentum met